This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News covering the Framingham and Metro West area. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will be bringing you news from the July 12th Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News. This is Craig Fife reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And we'll begin with the obituaries from the Sunday edition. Edward Beauchemin passed away peacefully at home on June 12th with Joan Longwell, his wife of 64 years, by his side. Those who knew Ed are invited to a celebration of life at the Short and Row Funeral Home in Marlborough on Saturday, July 25th, from 11 a.m. to noon, followed by a reception. In lieu of flowers, people are invited to make a donation in Ed's memory to Shriners Children's New England in Springfield, Massachusetts, or the Wounded Warrior Project. For more information and to view an online memorial, please visit www.shortandrowfuneralhome.com. That's shortandrowefuneralhome. Robert Y. Fudge, 88, of Upton, passed away peacefully on July 8th with his family by his side. Calling hours will be held on July 16th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Pickering and Son Upton Funeral Home, 45 Main Street, Upton. A Masonic service will be held at 6:45 p.m. Funeral services will be held on Friday, July 17th at 10:30 a.m. at Holy Spirit Episcopal Church, 3 Pleasant Street, Sutton. Committal with military honors at the Massachusetts National Cemetery and Bourn will be announced at the conclusion of the church service. In lieu of flowers, expressions of sympathy may be made in his memory to the Arthritis Foundation, www.info.arthritis.org/donate-today. For his online tribute, please visit www.uptonfunerals.com. That's UPTONFUNERALS. The Reverend Dr. Philip Joseph Joe Mayer, Jr. passed away peacefully at 78 years old after a long journey with Alzheimer's disease. A private burial at Greenlawn Cemetery in East Longmeadow will precede a memorial service on Saturday, September 19th at 2 p.m. at the Village Church in Wellesley, Massachusetts. And those are the obituaries from the Sunday edition. And continuing on now with some local news. Broke my heart. Residents react as South Natick Dam removal nears. This story is by Carolyn Bunnell, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. As water levels in the Charles River in South Natick continue to drop ahead of the removal of the aging dam, some residents are saddened to see the familiar site removed. Water levels are being lowered by about a foot per day ahead of construction and river restoration work, which is scheduled to begin July 16th as part of the first phase of a project to return the river to a free-flowing state. The Charles River Dam is considered a high-hazard dam, meaning that failure could cause loss of life, serious damage to homes, industrial, commercial facilities, important public utilities, highways, or railroads, according to the state. Once the dam is removed, there will be 19.6 miles of uninterrupted water flow of the Charles River. The project has drawn significant attention on social media, while residents have been stopping by the site on Pleasant Street to see the area before construction begins. On Wednesday, several residents took in the sunny weather while looking out over the depleted water levels and reflected on what the area will look like once the project is complete. Natick resident Bruno Giles told the Daily News that there has been a steady flow of people coming to the park in recent days. "It's kind of sad," he said. "My point of view is that people come here and relax by the waterfall. I'm not happy they're doing it, but I'm sure there's good points on both sides of the issue." A former Natick resident named Steve, who did not want his last name used, said the town was making a mistake by removing the dam. He said he grew up down the street and has fond memories of sliding down the dam as a child and sitting on the fish ladder during the summers. "My biggest concern is what it's going to look like," Steve said. "What is it going to look like in 5 years after they finish it? It broke my heart." He said he wants to see the town maintain the dam rather than remove it. He attended several Zoom meetings to voice his concerns and hear what town officials had to say, which he said was geared more toward demolition than restoration. Natick resident Diane Young, who has followed the project since 2021, told the Daily News in a phone interview that many residents have spent years opposing the plan. She said she collected a petition with 2,500 signatures from residents who were in opposition. "We gave that to the select board, and they did not even give it a thought," she said. "I think a lot of people feel that the decision was determined before anything happened." In November 2022, the select board voted 4-1 to remove the dam. Mike Hickey, who is no longer on the board, was the lone opposing vote. He favored repairing the dam. Young said many residents have not been properly informed about why the project is moving forward. The Office of Dam Safety cited mature tree growth on the berm as among the reasons for giving the dam a poor rating, according to the information on Natick's website. Young also emphasized the dam's significance to both community and the John Elliott Historic District, calling it the district's masterpiece. "They have taken away an iconic landmark that made Natick a very special place," she said, "especially today when people need places to go, to have peace with the world we're living in now. That has been taken from them." However, not everyone is opposed to the project. John Press and his son, Evan, stopped by the dam on Wednesday and reminisced about fishing and spending time in the area. While they acknowledged the loss of a familiar landmark, both said they believe the dam's removal will ultimately benefit the river. Evan Press, a former civil engineer who worked on several dam-related projects, said maintaining aging infrastructure can be costly. "Going back to the non-human manipulated state is probably better," he said. "When you dam up the river, it's like putting a highway somewhere. You kind of cut it off. If there's fish that live there, they won't have to go through that thing anymore." John Press said he's optimistic about plans to restore the river and improve the surrounding land. "I hope they really do clear out all the mud and make it more natural and more like the upstream is, where you feel like you're in a wilderness. That would be great." The spillway removal is expected to be completed by August 31st, with river restoration work continuing through October, Executive Director of the DPW and Facilities, Sam Spratt, previously told the Daily News. Employee facing child sex trafficking charges. This story is by Brad Patrician, Worcester Telegram and Gazette, USA Today Network. A Clinton man listed in court documents as being employed in April by Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School is facing federal and state charges relating to child sex trafficking. James Gill, a 39-year-old who told authorities he worked as a groundskeeper for the school, is accused of trying to pay for video-recorded sex with a 15-year-old during a sting operation. Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School Superintendent Andrew Stevens could not be immediately reached for comment July 8th on Gill, who was listed as an employee of the school in paperwork filed in Worcester District Court upon his April 6th arrest. A lawyer for Gill, Ryan P. Sullivan, could not immediately be reached for comment. Both Worcester and federal authorities charged Gill after arresting him in an undisclosed Worcester hotel during a sting operation April 6th. Federal authorities announced his arrest in a press release July 8th. According to a federal affidavit filed by an agent of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Gill in March answered an advertisement posted online by undercover agents conducting a sting. Gill, who introduced himself in a text as a groundkeeper at a local high school, agreed to pay $300 for a videotaped threesome with a woman and her 15-year-old sister, authorities allege. "I just have a tripod and my phone, if that works," authorities allege Gill texted the undercover officers March 14th in arranging a meeting for March 16th. "The meeting did not happen," authorities wrote, after Gill texted to say he was at an emergency veterinary appointment with his dog. Authorities allege Gill, on April 1st, agreed to pay $150 for unprotected video-recorded sex with the 15-year-old, sending a full-body nude picture of himself with his face visible beforehand and requesting a nude photograph of the girl. Gill was arrested April 6th after arranging for a meeting and being greeted at the agreed-upon hotel room by federal and Worcester law enforcement. Federal authorities charged Gill with attempted sex trafficking of a minor, which is punishable by a prison term of no less than 10 years and up to life in prison. Worcester police charged Gill with human trafficking of a minor, agreeing to pay for sex with a minor, and enticement of a child under age 16. Gill, at his Worcester District Court arraignment April 7th, was released on $2,500 bail on the condition he have no unsupervised contact or employment around anyone under 16. Gill, at an initial appearance in federal court in Worcester on Wednesday, July 8th, was ordered released to home detention with conditions that included no internet access and no contact with anyone under 18, the court records show. The sting is one of multiple sex buyer operations federal and local authorities have conducted in recent months, including one in March that led to arrests of then-director of the St. John's Food for the Poor program and an AbbVie scientist. Federal authorities in their news release announced Gill's arrest encouraged people who are experiencing or know anyone experiencing commercial sex trafficking to contact USAMA.victimassistance at usdoj.gov. And now let's take a short break.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl.org. www.blind-seniors.org.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 15 minutes past the hour. Pike Plaza Project back on road. Commission to review proposals. This story is by Kinga Borandi, Worcester Telegram and Gazette, USA Today Network. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation hopes to get developers bidding on contracts to refurbish the state's 18 travel plazas by September 3rd, when it hopes to publish a new request for proposal for the project. The members of a newly created public-private partnership commission met for the first time Wednesday, July 8th, in the Worcester Mass DOT facility on Paradise Parkway. They have a tight timeline and strict guidelines to follow as they review the RFP prior to its publication. The commission was created after the first attempt to select a company to refurbish the plazas collapsed in acrimony last year. The commission members include Kevin Sullivan, a vice president at Babson College and former state secretary of transportation, Joseph Bonfiglio, business manager of the Massachusetts and Northern New England Laborers District Council, Joseph Durant, an environmental engineer and former president of the Massachusetts Organization of State Engineers and Scientists, James Erickson, a municipal and regional planner, Eric Goodwine, a former member of the Worcester Business Development Corporation Board of Directors, and John Payne, a former state court judge. Commissioners and MassDOT officials spent an hour of their almost three-hour initial meeting discussing ethics, potential conflicts of interest, what constitutes public records, and outlining acceptable modes of communication between members and agency employees. "I will become your best friend," said Owen Kane, Deputy General Counsel of the MassDOT and the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. He stressed the importance of transparency. "My job is to keep you out of trouble. If there is a hint of something being wrong, call me." The commissioners, along with State Attorney General and the Office of the Inspector General, are slated to review the new proposed request for proposal July 22nd. The commissioners will then have 15 days to review and comment on the 1,000-page document. Officials at MassDOT are then scheduled to review and return the document with adjustments. Commissioners are scheduled to vote on the final version August 24th and release the document for bidders September 3rd. Review of the submitted bids will be the purview of others. One body will review the technical aspects of the proposals, and another separate group will evaluate their financial aspects. The state launched the initial procurement process for the refresh in 2024. That process resulted in accusations of a collusion and lack of transparency between bidders and agency reviewers, and a lawsuit against MassDOT filed by an unsuccessful Massachusetts-based bidder. It also precipitated a review by the state legislature and the Office of the Inspector General. That latter agency found that the appearance of collusion tainted the process and suggested that MassDOT failed to follow its own established rules and regulations during the process. The chosen contractor, Applegreen, an operator with a huge presence in Europe and other Atlantic seaboard states, including New York and New Jersey, walked away from negotiations with the state in September, tanking the entire process and leaving the state to start over. The roiling controversy prompted the state to create the Public-Private Partnership Commission to ensure transparency in the procurement process. Sullivan, the chairman of the commission, expressed concern that its members would be linked as the public face of the procurement process should controversy arise once again. The selection committee are all career professionals. Most will remain nameless to the public, Sullivan said. However, he said, the commission is determined to ensure the process is successful and benefits the agency, motorists, and taxpayers. We won't get another chance to revisit the process for 35 years. I'll be 120 by then, Sullivan said, noting that the project is the biggest procurement at $1 billion that he has ever been involved with. Agency officials assured the commission members that MassDOT has taken steps to safeguard the process. Changes include bundling the bid into three different packages, allowing contractors to bid on the whole package or smaller pieces of the pie. We love the three bundles, said Susan Snyder, Deputy General Counsel for MassDOT MBTA. The agency hopes the three separate packages will give smaller regional bidders a chance to apply for a contract. While the packages are almost identical, the agency has changed guidelines depending on local conditions. Some of the parameters are site-specific, said Andrew Paul, Director of Strategic Initiatives and Highway Design. He noted that, for example, the rest stop in Plymouth does not sell fuel. The agency expects there will be significant interest in the RFP once it is released. Review meetings have been scheduled for July 28th, 29th, and 30th. Police drone program to launch in fall. The story is by Norman Miller, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. When the Southborough Police Department needs a drone, such as for help in finding a missing child, it must seek mutual aid from nearby departments. But pretty soon that will change. That's because the Southborough Select Board, in a 3-2 vote on June 29th, approved spending $105,000 to start a drone program. We've had three instances out of nine using another department's drones in the past year that were missing children, said Police Chief Ryan Newell. I feel like just one of those incidents justifies the cost. Newell proposed using money left over from the fiscal 2026 budget because spending it had to be approved before June 30th. The money was available from the salary portion of the department's budget, thanks to some unfilled positions and a state grant that paid a portion of overtime. The $105,000 expenditure will cover the cost of the drone and other costs, such as storage. In addition, the Fay School, a private day school for students in grades K through 9, is donating $40,000, $20,000 now, and another $20,000 in October. As part of the contract, the department will get a software refresh after 2.5 years, Newell said. It will receive a new drone as part of the refresh, although only one drone will be active at a time, he said. Newell said getting the drone is important for public safety. Along with the three missing children, Southborough used a drone in the past year to search for fleeing suspects and a missing adult with emotional distress. A drone was also used to help search for a drowning victim recently. Southborough is the latest Metro West Police Department to start a drone program. Wayland started its program earlier this year. Ashland, Framingham, Hopkinton, Sudbury, Westboro, Milford, and Franklin are among the other departments that have drone units. Although mutual aid helps, Newell said there's always concerns and delays. When Southborough calls for mutual aid, it usually takes about 30 minutes or more for a drone to get into the air. And, he said, if the community where the drone came from has an emergency that would take precedence, if we have our own drone, it could be up in the air in 2 or 3 minutes, Newell said. He also said Southborough's topography makes the drone a good tool. With Southborough being surrounded by woods and having several bodies of water, I think it would be good to have one on hand. Currently, the department has two officers who are licensed to fly drones. Newell said the goal is to train several others so there is one trained officer on duty for each shift. That way, it can be used 24 hours a day. It can also be used for fires and other emergencies, Newell said. The two select board members who voted against the authorization, Kathy Cook and Andrew Pfaff, each said they supported the department having a drone, but preferred waiting for the fall town meeting to allow voters to decide on such a large expense. Newell said the drone would not likely be available for use until the fall. Conversion complete at Franklin's Old South Church. This story is by Beth McDermott, Milford Daily News, USA Today Network. This story was created with the assistance of artificial intelligence. A family has moved into the former South Franklin Congregational Meeting House at 762 Washington Street, also known as the Old South Church, according to a community announcement. The church, which has stood since 1856, was converted into a deed-restricted affordable home through a partnership between the Town of Franklin and Old Colony Habitat for Humanity. The project began in 2022 when the town sought to redevelop the historic property, according to the announcement. Old Colony Habitat for Humanity was selected through a competitive process to lead the renovation with support from volunteers, donors, local businesses, architects, contractors, and community partners. Following Habitat's homeowner selection process, the Marmol family, including a woman who works in Franklin, was selected to purchase the home. The family completed hundreds of hours of sweat equity alongside volunteers before receiving the keys. The home will remain deed-restricted as affordable housing in perpetuity, expanding Franklin's affordable housing inventory and returning the historic property to residential use, according to the announcement. The unit qualifies toward the town's Chapter 40B percentage. When I first learned that we had been selected for Habitat for Humanity, it felt like a dream, said new homeowner Sally Marmol in a statement. Standing in front of this beautiful home, that dream has finally become a reality. We are excited to become part of the Franklin community, to be good neighbors, and to give back whenever we can, just as so many people have given to us. The project represents everything Habitat for Humanity stands for, bringing people together to create strength, stability, hope, and hope through home ownership, added Old Colony Habitat for Humanity CEO Kim Thomas. We are incredibly grateful to the Town of Franklin, our sponsors, volunteers, tradespeople, and community partners for those whose unwavering support made this extraordinary project possible. Karen Reed investigation. 69% of Massachusetts residents believe police hid evidence. This story is by Bailey Allen, USA Today Network, New England. Most Massachusetts residents believe police concealed evidence in the Karen Reed case, according to a recent survey from the University of New Hampshire. In June 2025, Reed was found not guilty of second-degree murder and leaving the scene of a collision resulting in death. Prosecutors had accused her of backing into her Boston police officer boyfriend, John O'Keefe, with her Lexus SUV in a drunken rage and leaving him to die in the snow outside a Canton home in January 2022. Her defense attorneys claimed that she was framed by police in an investigation they described as rife with bias and incompetence. Since her acquittal last year, Reed has filed two lawsuits related to the case, one in November against witnesses and investigators, including former Massachusetts State Police Trooper Michael Proctor, and another in June against the Massachusetts State Police and the town of Canton. According to a statement sent to USA Today last month, Reed's defense team alleged that both agencies negligently permitted virulent misogynists and bigots to target her, referring to claims that investigators in her case sent hateful, racist, and sexist messages over the years. Throughout the case, Reed has amassed supporters from near and far, some of whom stood outside the courtroom during her trial wearing pink in solidarity and chanting, "Free Karen Reed." About 2,400 Massachusetts residents were randomly selected by the UNH Survey Center to give their opinion about police conduct in the Reed case. A total of 709 Massachusetts residents completed the survey between June 18th and June 23rd, the Survey Center said. Of Massachusetts residents who had heard about the Karen Reed case, 69% said they believe police definitely or probably concealed evidence in the investigation, according to the UNH survey. About 6% said they believe police definitely or probably did not conceal evidence, and 25% said they didn't know or have no opinion, the survey said. According to the UNH survey, about 67% of men and 70% of women said they believe police definitely or probably concealed evidence in the case. By age, about 72% of those ages 18 to 34, 67% of those ages 35 to 49, 73% of those ages 50 to 64, and 64% of those ages 65 and older said they believe police definitely or probably concealed evidence. In terms of political identification, about 74% of Republicans, 68% of Democrats, and 66% of Independents shared that view. By region, 75% of those in central Massachusetts, 77% of those in Essex County, 68% of those in Middlesex County, 63% of those in Norfolk and Suffolk counties, 78% of those in southern Massachusetts and the Cape and Islands, and 44% of those in western Massachusetts said the same. Views on police accountability, according to the UNH survey, 63% of Massachusetts residents said the Karen Reed case is evidence of a wider problem with police in Massachusetts. About 14% said it is definitely or probably not evidence of a wider problem, and 23% said they don't know or are not sure. About 86% of Massachusetts residents said people definitely or probably should be able to sue police departments if they believe their rights have been violated. About 8% said they definitely or probably should not be able to do so, and 5% said they don't know or have no opinion. Additionally, about 71% said people should definitely or probably be able to sue individual police officers under the same circumstances. About 21% said they believe they definitely or probably should not be able to do so, and 8% said they don't know or have no opinion. And now it's time for a short break.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 33 minutes past the hour. Brookline custom cake maker's future uncertain as rent rises. This story is by Joanna K. Tsouvelis, Wicked Local, USA Today Network. For six decades, party favors has been a fixture at Coolidge Corner, creating custom cakes and celebrating milestones for generations of families. But John and Mary Lynn Pergantis, who have owned the business for more than half of that time, 35 years, say its near-term future is, at the very least, uncertain. The primary reason? The coming expiration of the store's lease at 1356 Beacon Street. And while Mary Lynn Pergantis praised their landlord as incredibly generous and supportive, she said the rent would soon rise to market rates, which the business cannot sustain. The volume of business we would need is just not doable, she said. Although the bakery's custom cake business remains strong, walk-in traffic hasn't fully recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. People assume you're doing okay, but they don't realize the volume of business you need to do to pay rent in an area like this, Mary Lynn said. Despite announcing the business's closure, it looks like our last day will be July 15th. In a June 27th Facebook post, the owners say their story may not be over. They're still taking orders, exploring alternative locations, and discussing potential partnerships with interested businesses. People have been incredibly supportive and really positive about the brand we created, Mary Lynn said. They want to help us sustain the brand and brainstorm about ways we can carry this forward. The couple are hoping to relocate party favors and create a leaner business centered on custom cakes, online ordering, and corporate accounts, rather than party supplies and walk-in traffic. One thing John said he was not interested in, retirement. No desire to slow down or retire, he said. As they consider what comes next, both owners hope party favors will be remembered, not just for its cakes, but for the joy it brought to the community. As a fun, happy place that brings happiness to people, Mary Lynn said. People travel from throughout the state and beyond to get custom cakes from party favors. There are few other places to get cakes frosted, like a floral garden basket, an animal farm, a house, a stack of presents, a unicorn, minion, and so much more. The custom cake business is steady, said Mary Lynn, who has enjoyed helping customers fulfill their cake design dreams. John and his team of decorators bring the designs to life. The couple said they're most proud of their custom cake creations, which have earned the business multiple Best of Boston awards and made it a regional institution. Among their favorite creations are a replica of the Museum of Fine Arts, excuse me, a giant lamp cake inspired by A Christmas Story, and an elaborate Dr. Seuss-themed cake created for a theater production. Founded in 1965 by Dorothy and Ben Rack, Party Favors was purchased by the Pergantises in 1992 after the Racks approached them about taking over. For John, who has worked there since childhood, taking ownership fulfilled a lifelong dream. After graduating from the Culinary Institute of America and working in hotels, John continually returned to Party Favors. Looking back on the past 35 years, he said the experience has been deeply rewarding. John says he feels like George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life. This was my dream, he said. The past 35 years have been amazing. Some staff members have been with Party Favors for decades. Four couples who met while working at the business have gone on to marry, including the Brigantises, who celebrate their 37th anniversary on July 22nd. Since the closure announcement, the phone at Party Favors has been ringing nonstop, and a line has been consistently stretched out the door. Mary Lynn said some customers cried in response to hearing the news. They don't know what they're going to do because our cakes have become such an important part of their family milestones, she said. Many customers recalled ordering cakes for birthdays, weddings, and now their children's celebrations, underscoring the bakery's multi-generational impact. I love that we're generational, John said. We've created cakes for generations of families. Helen Henricks of Arlington said she discovered Party Favors 2 decades ago at a baby shower and became a loyal customer due to the bakery's signature frosting. Since then, we've been hooked. Another customer, Boston resident Suzanne Nathan, said she purchased family birthday cakes at Party Favors for 35 years. They're irreplaceable, she said. I'm going to have icing withdrawal. Brookline resident Nick Clinton started a GoFundMe campaign to raise funds to help the Brigantises pay off debt, cover back rent, and help them find a more affordable location. As of 10 a.m. on Wednesday, July 8th, the account had raised $10,855 toward a goal of $35,000. Texas faculty sue over restrictions on teaching. This story is by Brianna J. Frank, USA Today Network. University faculty members sued the Texas Tech University system in federal court on July 8th, alleging it created an extraordinary system of censorship through restrictions on course content related to race and gender. The Texas American Association of University Professors, American Federation of Teachers, and the National Association of University Professors brought the lawsuit against Texas Tech University System Chancellor Brandon Crichton and the University System's Board of Regents. The faculty groups accused them of working to obscure documented history, facts, and theories related to certain perspectives on race, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Under this censorship regime, professors cannot teach Plato's Republic, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Between the World and Me, and the fact that gay and bisexual men were persecuted in Nazi Germany, or the existence of health disparities in rural communities in Lubbock and border communities in El Paso, reads the complaint, filed in U.S. District Court for the Western District of Texas. It alleges one professor was barred from even using the word systemic. The complaint argued the alleged actions violated the First Amendment, as well as the 14th Amendment's Due Process and Equal Protection Clause. Aaron Wilson, a spokesperson for Crichton's office, said in a July 9th email to USA Today that the Texas Tech University system is confident its policies are lawful, constitutionally sound, and fully compliant with state and federal laws. Our commitment to academic integrity and the First Amendment rights of our students and faculty will not be distracted by lawsuits as we continue our mission to deliver rigorous academic programs, relevant coursework, and groundbreaking research, Wilson said. USA Today reached out to the Board of Regents for comment. The complaint centered on 2 alleged directives from Crichton related to course content surrounding race, gender, and sexuality. The first was issued on December 1st, 2025, according to the complaint, and imposed restrictions that include a prohibition on promoting the ideas that someone, by virtue of race or sex, is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, consciously or unconsciously, and that there are more than two genders. It also requires faculty members to follow a review process if they believe any of their course materials touched on such topics. The second directive came on April 9th and established criteria to govern this review process at the discretion of the Board of Regents, the complaint said. Crichton's guidelines are vague and contradictory, according to the complaint, which also said faculty members have begun to immediately and constructively self-censor constitutionally protected speech about race, gender identity, and sexual orientation. And now let's take a short break.
Have you listened to one of Audio Journal's most popular shows, Talking Topics, with host Bill Ruggiero? You can catch it on the second weekend of each month, airing Saturday at 3 p.m. and again on Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 46 minutes past the hour. Electric school buses offer a route to power relief. This story is by Lisa Bartline, Reuters. Schools are out for the summer, but the batteries in more than 200 electric school buses are helping some people in the United States find relief when temperatures soar. From California to North Carolina, yellow school buses are sending power back to the grid, easing some strain when demand spikes during heat waves. Hundreds more are expected to come online. The stored energy in school buses and other electric vehicles is dwarfed by that of power plants, but the efforts to use their batteries to return the power to the electrical systems, known as vehicle-to-grid, show how EVs could fortify strained power grids. Fully deployed V2G projects involving about 230 of the nation's roughly 6,700 electric school buses now have the capacity to supply about 8 megawatt hours of power at a given time, according to the World Resources Institute's Electric School Bus Initiative. It's very early days. School buses will be a critically important backbone of V2G capacity, said Steve Letondre, senior advisor to the Vehicle Grid Integration Council Trade Association. Electric school buses have large batteries, some exceeding 200 kilowatt hours. They can charge when demand is low and send power back to the utility. They are often idle in the summer when electricity demand surges. At least 31 utilities and 21 states are involved in V2G school bus projects, WRI said. Still, capacity from V2G electric school bus projects needs to grow exponentially to make a meaningful difference. Consulting firm ICF forecasts 445,000 megawatts of U.S. grid capacity additions through 2030, partly driven by the data center boom. V2G projects face hurdles including upfront costs and a lack of universal V2G technology. Regulatory frameworks and standards are years away. Electric vehicle owners and operators face concerns that repeated charging and discharging of a battery could accelerate battery degradation, and that use of V2G could void a battery warranty. Electric buses do not spew tailpipe pollution, But critics of vehicle electrification and government public investment in alternative energy projects argue they could tax the grid. To combat that, many schools are beginning to lean on solar energy for charging. California leads the United States in developing and adopting V2G school bus technology. Its largest project is the Oakland Unified School District, where Pacific Gas and Electric and transit provider Zoom operate a fleet of 74 buses estimated to generate 2.1 gigawatt hours of electricity annually. A separate Zoom project with the San Francisco Unified School District is set to launch next month. It is expected to surpass the Oakland project, with a starting fleet of 104 buses returning about 3 gigawatt hours of energy annually during peak hours. The fleet will more than double to 238 electric buses in 2027-28. In Connecticut, the Branford Public School District will have 46 V2G-capable electric buses in August. Red List says mining threatens mollusks. This story is by Emma Farg, Reuters. Over half of mollusk species that cluster around underwater vents and hold promising potential for medicine and technology are at risk of going extinct due to increasing deep-sea mining, the world's largest conservation network warned on July 9th. The International Union for Conservation of Nature renewed its call for a moratorium on such operations before UN-led talks later this month. A growing number of firms extract critical minerals such as copper, cobalt, or zinc from the superheated fluids emitted by natural hydrothermal vents on the ocean floor. These species, though constituting less than 1% of global mollusk biodiversity, play a vital role in the food webs of deep-sea vents. According to the IUCN's latest Red List of threatened species, 62% of vent-dwelling mollusk species, 125 out of 201, are now classified as at risk of extinction due to mining operations, which create sediment blankets that disrupt entire ecosystems. Deep sea mining would smother the entire ecosystem, Dr. Chong Chen, a member of IUCN's mollusk specialist group, told Reuters, explaining that the loss of mollusks at a particular vent field would also mean the loss of all other non-mollusk vent species. Chen said some of the vent mollusks have already proven to hold value for human society, such as a scaly foot snail that has developed a biomineralization process that is helping researchers produce nanoparticles for new technologies like solar cells. Others are being studied to help develop alternatives to plastics. Allowing these species to go extinct would also mean losing biological solutions to future challenges in medicine, materials, technology before we even had the chance to discover them, he added. The Red List was released ahead of a meeting of the UN's International Seabed Authority in Jamaica from July 13th to 31st to decide how to regulate metals extraction from the ocean floor. IUCN and other groups have called for such activities to be banned, but many governments want the opposite. President Donald Trump's administration has accelerated permitting for U.S. companies hunting for minerals in international waters. New York requires anti-ice law compliance for grant. This story is by Emily Barnes, New York State Team, USA Today Network. A New York State grant program providing millions of dollars providing millions of dollars to help police departments and sheriff's offices advance their technology and equipment now requires compliance with the state's immigration and enforcement restrictions. Departments applying for the second round of the Law Enforcement Technology, or LETECH, grant program will allocate $75 million to agencies outside New York City through the recently passed state budget, which will need to adhere to the recently enacted Local Cops, Local Crimes Act to receive funding. New York's law has drawn criticism, especially among police departments across the state, as it bans formal cooperation pacts, or 287G agreements, that allow local law enforcement agencies may sign with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The group representing sheriff's departments around New York previously defended those agreements and said they are safety measures simply allowing jails to transfer an incarcerated person to the custody of federal agents in a safe setting. And that's all the time we have for this news broadcast. You have been listening to a reading of the Metro West Daily News for Sunday, July 12, 2026. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Craig Fife, and I thank you for listening.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
This is Bird Note. Ecologist Adrian Doctor was entranced by birds at an early age.
I grew up in the Netherlands, close to the sea in the city of Haarlem. And, you know, there were a lot of migratory birds around. So I would climb on a dune top and sit there early in the morning and just see all these birds go by. I was very fascinated with common swifts. They're really the sound of the summer, and you hear them screeching over your house, even if you live in a city like I did. But the cool thing about these birds is they're really ultimate flyers.
Common swifts spend most of their lives in the air. They migrate thousands of miles between continents, feasting on flying insects, and even sleeping on the wing. In fact, the only time swifts need to land is while they're nesting.
And after that, they're just off, and they fly almost for 10 months, nonstop, through the air. That really fascinated me, that birds can be so adapted to flight and just be such an ultimate flyer.
Today, Adrian uses weather radar to study how birds migrate and what people can do to protect them on their journey. Hear more about Adrian's research in Season 8 of Bring Birds Back, available in your favorite podcast app and on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Joni Franklin.
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And at the Mass Commission for the Blind, we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Call 1-800-492-6450. 392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.